This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers produce over 600 varieties, types, and styles of cheese. That's twice as much as any other state. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, bars, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Todd Cavallo. We'll talk to Todd about permaculture, biodynamics, the Hudson Valley, Wild Ark Farm, and a lot more. We'll taste at least a Piquette. And do we have a carbonic Marquette here?
It's a Marquette, but it's not. Okay.
And Todd loaded up the table with a bunch of other wines. So we're going to be tasting that throughout the show. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. All right, Todd Cavallo left Brooklyn with his wife, Crystal, in 2016 to try his hand at sustainable food systems. He is the proprietor of Wild Ark Farm, located in the heart of the Hudson Valley, just north of New York City. Wild Ark Farm is a pursuit of sustainable food and beverage production within the small farm environment. Wild Ark is an experiment in biodynamic permaculture and viticulture, producing exciting wines like Piquette, Pet Nat, Riesling, hybrid grapes like Marquette, and more. Todd is also a 2019 40 Under 40 tastemaker from Wine Enthusiasts. Bet your mom loved that.
Yeah, I think I'm finally legit.
There you go. Todd, welcome to the Grape Nation.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on. I've bumped into you a bunch of times at different portfolio tastings, and it seems like since then things are going pretty well. It's not why I'm having you on, but there's a lot of good things to talk about.
Yeah,
so
I can't complain.
Let's give the listener an idea of who you are and where you came from. So give me a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you to the Hudson Valley and Wild Ark Farm.
Well, we weren't really like a wine-drinking family growing up, but one of my earliest memories of wine being like a big part of the table was coming to the city when I was 17 to look at colleges, and then going out to some restaurant in Little Italy, and my dad ordered some probably industrial Chianti, who knows, whatever they had there, but they put down a glass for every single person at the table, including me, who was underage at the time. And I was just like, oh, it's, you know, I guess, you know, it's part of the meal. Everyone drinks, or whoever wants to drink can drink. And then, you know, I spent six dark years not drinking a lot of wine after that because I was in college and we drank a bunch of cheap beer.
When you said came into the city, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Central New York, in Syracuse.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I'm a New Yorker through and through.
Right.
And yeah, so then I came to the city for school and, you know, drank a little wine here and there, but it wasn't really until after I graduated that, you know, friends and I started drinking more serious wines and going out to the restaurants that were in the city and seeing what was available. I think, you know, my partner and I and some of our friends had a tasting at Babbo, and it was the first time I had had a bunch of that really, really good Barolo, and then some Barolo Chinato, so some weirdo stuff too.
Right.
And then I had two younger brothers who worked in the industry in the city for a dozen years, and through a lot of their friends, we met people in the industry and drank a lot of weird wines and were introduced to a lot of wines and, you know, started drinking a little bit, still mostly Italian, but a little weirder stuff, like a little Paolo Bea, and got into his Santa Chiara, which was probably the first orange wine that I had. And that introduced me to a whole new world. And then just eating in the restaurants in the city that had forward-thinking wine lists at the time. We had some more orange wines at, like, Sambar and other restaurants that were doing that stuff. And then kind of, you know, along the same, in the same time, my partner Crystal would be researching and reading about wine and saw some documentary about biodynamic wine. And we didn't really understand at the time, you know, 10 years ago, what that really meant, but we were interested in it. And so we started seeking those wines out. And so,
A documentary kind of fired the whole interest up to an extent?
In the biodynamic side of things. But then you start drinking those wines and you start realizing how much more alive they are and how great they taste and, you know, how the philosophy behind it is a lot more wholesome than drinking something made by a corporation. And so, yeah, so we just had been kind of consumers for a long time until maybe, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago or so, a few years before we moved up there, we had started spending a lot of time upstate, hiking and camping. And we had this idea of getting a weekend house and keeping a place
in the city. And you were in Brooklyn.
City. I was in
so
Brooklyn,
we're talking
yeah.
Brooklyn and looking upstate a little.
Right, exactly, like everyone loves right. to do now. Little cliche, but I'll embrace it. And we realized just we could never afford a weekend house and to keep a place in the city. So we gave up on that idea. But then through a series of real estate drama, not real estate, but just apartment drama, we decided to get out of the city because we had this rent-stabilized apartment that was perfectly located and super cheap, but the ceiling collapsed in the bedroom, and then the kitchen cabinet fell off the wall and almost killed Crystal.
With your plates in it?
All gone. And so we moved to a new apartment, new construction building in Windsor Terrace, and spent a year there, and it was almost just as bad, like no heat or hot water for half the winter, sewage explosions. And so at that point, we're like, someone is telling us, like, get out of New York. So we went back to looking upstate again, but with an idea of moving up there, not keeping an apartment, finding something that was commutable because I still had a job in the city. And
quickly, what were you doing? Nothing to do with wine.
No, nothing to do with wine. I worked in tech, but not in like the kind of tech where you make a lot of money. I had a small consulting company with some partners. We did it for a dozen years together, and I did mostly software development. And I tried to get into the food and beverage world because we did some work with Jean-Georges Restaurant Group and Momofuku and those guys.
Through the tech door?
Thing. Yeah, yeah. And then we said, let's get out of the city, and you know, I'll keep doing that. And we had kind of like a 10-year plan to maybe learn how to make some wine and retire in 10 years early and start a winery. But what happened is we bought some fruit and we got our license right away just because we wanted to be able to sell wine. And we made like a barrel the first year and it turned out pretty good. And because
this was bought, contracted.
Yeah, we bought some fruit. Yeah,
not
yeah.
even contracted.
Yeah. Negotiate fruit,
yeah.
sure.
Right.
So we bought
That's incredibly fast.
Well, it was just supposed to be like, hey, let's see if we can figure this out. Let's buy some fruit and make some wine. And it was, like I said, just a barrel, 25 cases. But because I had so many friends in the industry through my brothers and their friends and people that we've met, I was able to get those wines in front of people and they were able, you know, they bought them. We sold a bunch of wine to our friends and then to restaurants in the city from that first tiny little vintage.
So here's what I don't get, and this is kind of a nosy personal question.
Sure.
I mean, you kind of like pack everything and go up there. I mean, obviously, you had a few bucks in your pocket in the bank. I mean, not to bankroll you for the rest of your life.
No,
but
no.
You had that cushion?
We spent all our money buying the property and the house.
Okay.
And so we had the plan to keep my job, and I had a decent enough salary. And so I had my job for the first 2 years, and I commuted part-time to the city. And then, so after that first year went so well, we said, let's make some more wine. So in 17, we made like 400 cases of wine, a little bit more. And again, it was received well. People wanted it. I was spending a lot of time selling it. And my old business partners in the city said, you know, you seem pretty focused on this wine thing. Maybe it's time to get out of here. And so, you know, in a nice way, we separated from them. And I got like, you know, what I call a bronze parachute. It's not a lot of money,
right.
but it was enough for me to, you know, buy a little bit more equipment and not have to go, you know, a lot of money in debt to start the winery. But
right.
we're still, I mean, if you see, we're in a dirty old barn. It's barely sealed up and we got a bunch of old, small equipment. So
I think that's the charm of it all, you know?
Yeah. I hope that comes through in the glass.
You went up there and you knew you wanted to do some kind of sustainable and biodynamic farming. You knew you were going to buy wine?
I knew I was going to have to buy fruit.
Not that quickly, though. I
mean, right.
You bought it right away.
Yeah, I thought maybe we...
So the 10-year plan was really a 2-1-year
plan.
Well,
it turned into a 2-year
right,
plan,
right, right.
Yeah.
Right. So you're off to the races. Let's talk about the area. I'm very intrigued, you know, because you're really dug in there now. Can you grow world-class or interesting wines in the Hudson Valley?
I think you absolutely can. And the story that we all tell up there is that we have both the oldest and the longest-running wineries in the country there.
It's a storied wine region.
Yeah. It was the original. I mean, the French Huguenots planted grapes in the 1600s, and they were some of the first in the country. And then, Brotherhood and Benmarle wineries have been around forever. And there's been some ups and downs,
But even... Drill it down a little. Can you grow world-class wines? That's the big question. Or the wines that are important and acceptable to you in your context, which is a small, biodynamic, permaculture, sustainable environment?
Well, that I would say is maybe TBD. We can grow world-class wines there, and we are working with the other growers that we work with to move towards full organic production there. Our first step is we try to get people off of herbicides, and we have a vineyard, Brunswick Vineyard, 10 minutes up the road from us, and the first year we started working with them, they stopped using herbicide, and they just have to spend a lot of
under
time
weed whacking
now. Under your influence. Yeah.
They were like sold. I mean, how do you argue that, right?
Yeah, and then, we brought them to Raw Wine Fair that year, and we introduced them to all the people doing this stuff and gave them some books, and they're like, oh, okay, this is a thing. This is worldwide. It's not just some weirdo in the Hudson Valley. And we've moved them towards some organic antifungal sprays, and we're just trying to kind of help people in that direction by offering them monetary incentives, buying them sprays, offering to help out in whatever way we can.
Are you the sole evangelist, or there's a few people up there that are carrying the message?
There are people who are catching on, and there are people who aren't making wine commercially yet who are up there definitely growing this way and
right.
doing hybrid stuff in small home vineyards, and you get to meet all those people because they're like, oh, this guy's doing it, on a larger scale. Let's talk, and, we're maybe getting some fruit in from a friend who has a biodynamic vineyard nearby, very, very small, but maybe help him make a couple of demijohns of wine this year and see what happens.
Right. You may have sort of answered this question, but in the region, and in a few minutes I'll have you talk about terroir, climate, grapes and all that, but in the region, is it tougher to be organic, biodynamic, or that's not a...
It's very, very, very difficult. The disease pressure from...
Because of the climate and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, from the moisture, the mildew,
right.
And
typical
and
Northeast.
The rock pressure, exactly, yeah. So there are vineyards, in California that...
So you're challenged.
Yes, yeah. And the climate, too, we'll get to separately. But to talk about just the disease pressure and the mildew, like there are vineyards in California that talk about never having to spray antifungals. They're just dry. And so it's a great way to be able to grow, but not a lot of those vineyards are also dry farming. So, the question is having to use 50,000 gallons an acre of water a year to irrigate your vineyard, but not having to spray synthetics or antifungals any better in the long run for the local ecosystem,
right?
Which is I don't know. I can't say which is better or for worse. But I just know that we have never had to irrigate, and we never did when we planted our fruit. We didn't when we planted our trees, other than a couple buckets of water for the beginning of the season. But we do have extreme mildew pressure, and we're still learning what works and what doesn't. We tried to not spray any copper for the whole entire first year, and we were almost completely defoliated by downy mildew.
You're hardcore, man.
And
kicked in the ass.
It's tough, yeah. And we're working, with some new bio antifungals that I was excited about, but one of them is this product that's owned by Bayer and Monsanto, and so we don't want to, support them. So we found another company making the same version of this Bacillus subtilis strain. And so I bought some of that this year, and it shows up in a box that says manufactured by Bayer in Mexico.
Oh,
because
boy.
They're just licensing it from them.
So
we're learning as we go, and we're learning the natural stuff that works. And we've got, sulfur is the old thing that everyone does and that works forever. And then milk for powdery mildew, but downy mildew and black rot are the hard ones, and so we're still kind of struggling our way through that.
So it sounds like you've experimented, addressed most of it. You're almost there. I mean,
well,
like you said,
so
by
then,
not using copper,
yeah,
you
we're figuring it out on that side. But then on the other side, we planted 1,200 new vines last year, and
on your property,
on our property, yeah. And we lost about 70% of them to winter kill, and it was just the worst year. To
weather,
plant.
Cold,
cold. Yeah, there was. There
Is
was,
it because they were so young?
Because they were so young, because it was one of the rainiest seasons in like 100 years, so they were not very strongly established already, and then there was an early frost, and then there was a polar vortex in January, and then there was late frost in April. So the combination just basically took these little baby vines and beat them into submission. So basically all of our Chardonnay block that we planted is dead. We've still got some Pinot and some Cab Franc, but now the question is, like, we're going to be 2 years behind, because in the spring nobody has vines to order anymore from the nurseries. So now we have to wait another year to replant that middle block. And so we're behind for a lot of reasons.
That apartment in Brooklyn with the ceiling falling in kind of looks good after a season like that.
Just a little dry cleaning bill to clean up those clothes. That's not as bad as
no. So explain something to me, because you alluded to it, you know, when you were planting trees. You practice what is permaculture, right? I mean, it's part of your... Explain what permaculture is, or how you do it, or
it's pretty broad, and it has a number of definitions. What we're looking at is to create a kind of self-contained ecosystem that doesn't require a lot of inputs or a lot of work from us as farmers. Farming, regardless of how thoughtfully you're doing it, you're still imposing your will on the land. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to plant a lot of more heirloom and native trees and a mixed block of them. So you're not planting just, hey, like, let's get 500 of the same clone of apple trees. We've got no more than 3 of any one variety of apple. They're all full-size trees. They're all broad, widely spaced. And then around those, you plant what's called a guild planting. So you've got things like alliums that keep certain pests away. You've got flowers that attract pollinators. And then you've got an understory planted too. So you're the idea there is that you're actually able to absorb more of the sun's energy in a smaller square footage footprint, because you're taking multiple layers of sun exposure. So you've got your big trees, and then you've got your kind of bushes, and then you've got your low shrubs underneath that. And they're in a triangular kind of, like solar panels. You know, they're getting at the right angle to absorb the most sun. But we're still years in,
like,
so we're not established
at
there.
At least
either.
With biodynamics, there was like these Steiner guidelines or something. How do you figure all this stuff out? I mean, there's enough written about
it. Yeah, yeah. There's this guy, Sepp Holzer, who is Austrian, right?
I think he's Austrian.
Yeah, yeah.
Austrian.
So he's
the guy, right?
He's been doing it there. And so he did a lot of the stuff with the Huckel culture mounds. And we have that stuff too with wildflowers broadcast on them. And so, yeah, we read a lot of books. We listen to a lot of podcasts. You know, there's a lot of information out there for us. And then it's just a matter of finding the other people doing this stuff and talking to them
Very
about
cool.
what works and what doesn't.
So let's talk about that haunting term, natural wine.
Sure.
If people have been listening for the first 15 minutes, you know, they realize you're seriously and deep into it. But you've said that the term is being redefined daily. And I couldn't agree more. And it's so fluid. So what I want to hear from you is, because it's being redefined daily and it's so fluid, where is natural wine, the wines, the movement? Where's it at in your mind, you know, today? And I'll say, you're so busy trying to accomplish this stuff, it's hard to think about it. But then, you know, you come up for air and you're a natural wine producer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I love the strictest definition. I love it's, you know, organically farmed fruit that is made with, you know, zero sulfur, some would say. I would say minimal sulfur. We're not afraid of sulfur. We'll use a little bit here and there if we feel cuvée warrants it. But last year, we're probably about 40% were zero sulfur cuvées that we put out. And the rest had maybe 10 or 20 parts per million added at crush and not at bottling, so it's really gone by the end anyway. But, you know, we had a wine that got a little mousy after it was open for 3 days, and I did experiments where I injected sulfur through the cork in these sealed bottles, and as little as 10 ppm solve the problem, and I couldn't tell the difference side by side between the two.
So you'd made the wine, you'd corked it, you tested a few samples.
And it got mousy after 3 or 4 days.
And you like Coravined it or essentially, stuck stuff, you know, with a hypodermic?
Yeah, I got someone to send and me that, some hypodermic needles.
Which that solved the problem?
Get, actually. And it's, I didn't do it on the whole batch,
right,
but it was a learning
to see
experience.
If it would.
Yeah. And so now I know we bench test all our wines before bottling. We take the blend from the barrel, we put it in a bottle. Seal it, leave it for a couple of days, open it up, and then bench test it and give it a trial. And if it goes anyway sideways, then we'll do some tests and see if a little 5, 7, 10 ppm sulfur dose solves it. And if it does, and if I can't, as the winemaker, differentiate between the dosed and the non-dosed version, I'm going to put a little bit of sulfur in there. But I also am completely open about
it. You don't have a problem with that.
No, no. And I am now, I mean, you can look at the back of our labels. It's got the sulfur dosage for each cuvée that we have here. And I'm totally open and honest about it. So for me, honest wine is kind of the more important moniker.
Right, transparency.
Yeah, than fitting into a box that is ill-defined sometimes.
I agree with that.
And also some of our grapes are grown conventionally because I can't get as many growers as I want to work with me up front. And so sometimes what we do is we'll buy a couple tons from someone and say, hey, if this works out next year, maybe can we think about getting off herbicides? And then the year after that, maybe we can move to organic.
Have you gotten to that point yet?
Yeah, we have some younger growers who are more willing to talk to us about that. And so we're establishing some longer-term contracts now. But again, the same thing is we just put it out there and we say, hey, look, this is conventionally grown. We're charging a little bit less for it. But just so you know.
Where is that? On the website? The label?
On the website, we have some keys on the labels, but we're trying not to anger the TTB by putting anything on there that we're not allowed to. So it'll be in all the tech sheets and then it'll be.
So your influence, your evangelical push, the fact that you're a buyer now. There'll be a point soon where you won't have to touch conventional grapes, right?
I mean, let's hope so. Yeah. That's the hope, for sure. But also, part of that and part of the permaculture idea is that like it's not necessarily great to be putting more vineyards in the ground. Again, it's like it's farming, it's enforcing your will on the land.
There's the balance.
Yeah. So if I'm out there and I'm growing and I'm like, oh, I'm going to put in 10 more acres of grapes and I'm going to pull out this native grassland or whatever is there, that's not really great as far as being someone who's thoughtfully sustainable. And so what we're thinking about now is more of like how many more acres can we get that exist moved into a more thoughtful growing paradigm.
So you have to buy and expand on.
Right, and get buy-in
if
from.
If you honor the system you set out to practice and all of that. On the natural wine thing, people can farm organically or have great farming practices and they screw it up in the cellar, right? I mean, that's still going on.
Sure, yeah.
Like the sulfur thing or any of the zillions of Alice firing was on a couple of weeks ago. The 70 additives you know, you can put on wine.
And
all that.
And, you know, even organic wine in the U.S., you can't have sulfur in it, but you can have up to those additives.
Which is crazy, the way it's,
I think needs to change.
That's why it's being redefined daily, or it's being abused daily, or it's misunderstood daily.
Sure,
and all
that.
But I think transparency is an important thing, and, you know, that's something that you practice. All right, let's talk about the Hudson Valley, and let's talk about, you know, when you get up every day for the four seasons. Give me an idea of the terroir soil you're dealing with, the climate.
So the AVA.
And the challenges.
The Hudson River region AVA is pretty huge. We always say it's basically from the Bronx to Albany. It's just like there's so many diverse terroirs in there, both geologically and climate influenced, that it's hard to really talk about it as one thing. But where we are and where most of our fruit is coming from is the mid-Hudson Valley. And we're kind of right below this ridge called the Shawangunk Ridge, if you've ever been up and seen the gunks. And
great hiking area.
Yeah, and climbing. You can see these just carved out white cliff faces of quartz and granite. And so a lot of that quartz and granite is in the soil as boulders and pebbles, and there's some decomposed granite that forms a lot of the soil.
So they're granitic soils.
Granitic soils, yeah. But they're also a bunch of glacial till, so there's stuff that's dropped off in there from God knows where, from eons ago. And so it's not really easily identifiable. And then there's also, you know, in our vineyard specifically, we have a lot of area right in the center where there's a lot of red clay about 12 to 18 inches down. Uh-huh. And it's only in one area, and it's, you know, pretty concentrated. But, you know, I think about it as primarily granitic, and that's what we're thinking about with the flavor profiles that we're getting from this fruit. You know, it's
what does it impart? Like, what do you pick up?
I think about like the Northern Rhone, or I think about Beaujolais. I think about kind of a lighter, lither style of red wine. And we make reds and whites, and reds are not really very well regarded from New York State. But I think the greatest thing that the natural wine movement has brought to the table is this ability to look at wines of a region as what they are and not try to compare them to other things and to say, oh, this region can make 11%, 10% red wines that are light on their feet and light in color and light in body, but, you know, a little chill or great with food. And so that's, you know, that's what does well where we are. And so, and again, then we have a little bit of clay in the middle. So maybe those more clayey vineyards in the Hudson River region are the places where you can try to push the texture a little bit further. You can try to get a little bit richer, rounder, fattier red wines, or, you know.
But you have a shorter growing season.
We do. We have a shorter growing season. Yeah.
So does that affect, you know, tannin, acidity?
It affects, we can maintain acidity really well, obviously. We don't have the ability to build as much skin tannin because we're not having as much sun on the grapes once they've gone through veraison before we have to harvest them. Things cool down around now. Things start to get harvested. And really from now until October, we're harvesting, but in my opinion, because we have the longer, hotter days in August and early September, we get phenolic ripeness out of the way a little earlier. And then I think that sugar ripeness, those Brix levels, are just kind of like a long tail that comes along at the end, and slowly you're kind of waiting for those to come up. But one of the things that we do that's a little bit more, a little different than what has been done in the region in the past is that we do a lot of whole cluster with stems on, and people are always worried about it. If you can't get the grapes ripe, then the stems are going to be really unripe, and they're going to make bitter, horrible, undrinkable wines. But we've gone up to, the skin contact Treminet that we do is 100% whole cluster, 2-week maceration, and there's no bitterness left in there. And this Marquette is 50% whole cluster. The Teraldigo we did last year was 40%. And you get out there in the vineyard and you open up the grapes and you chew on the skins and you chew on the seeds and you chew on the stems and you see what the flavors are that are in there, and you might be making a 10 or 11% wine that's not very, you know, sugar rich, but if those phenolically ripe compounds are where they're supposed to be, then throw the stems in there.
What about alcohol? Do the ripe grapes yield a lower alcohol or typical?
I mean, 18 is a perfect example because across the state people had a hard time pushing ripeness. Really, really good growers. Like, you know, our friends at Bloomer Creek were able to get their Cab Franc up to 23, but really from Finger Lakes, Hudson River region, and Long Island, all our grapes came in under 20, some closer to 18 or 19. So we have a lot of wines coming out this vintage that are like 10%. And I enjoy them. I like them. They're still full of flavor. They're interesting, but it's a light wine for sure.
Yeah. Todd, we have to take a quick break. I'm breaking early. We're talking to Todd Cavallo. Todd is the proprietor of Wild Ark Farm. When we come back, we're going to talk about Wild Ark, the grapes, what he's making, a lot of interesting things, Piquette and all that. We're going to subject Todd to the wine list, and we're going to... We started tasting a bunch of wines, but we're going to taste more and taste for our weekly wine sip. So you're listening to the Grape Nation. We'll be right back. Don't you weep. And Mary had two lengths of chain, and every chain was freedom's name. Charles Army got drowned.
Since the mid-1800s, before Wisconsin was even recognized as a state, its resident cheesemakers have been putting the art into artisan cheese. When early settlers from Switzerland, Germany, and Italy came to Wisconsin, they brought their cheesemaking expertise with them. They chose Wisconsin because the terroir reminded them of the homes they'd left behind in Northern Europe. The soil and water of Wisconsin is nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin's cheesemakers draw from their rich European heritage and cheesemaking traditions, and combine them with incredible innovation to produce half of the nation's specialty cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers never stop experimenting, trying to improve, and dreaming of your next favorite cheese that has yet to be imagined. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. I'm Damon Bolte.
And I'm Souther Teague.
Together we host The Speakeasy, a show where we discuss cocktails, spirits, wine, beer, tea, coffee, and all things in the liquid universe.
Yeah, our guests range from bartenders and brewers, alchemists and ambassadors, roasters and regulars, hippies and homebrewers, and every expert enthusiast in between.
Browse episodes of The Speakeasy wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back. You're listening to The Grape Nation. Our guest is Todd Cavallo. Todd is from Wild Ark Farm up in the Hudson Valley in New York. Todd, I want to talk to you about the actual farm, Wild Ark Farm. So we talked about it a little. You purchased 10 acres about when you got up there, right?
Yeah.
And you even talked about expanding a little, you know, if and when that comes. So let's get a little more into your cellar and farming practices. I guess the first question is, what are you doing on your own property? Where are you getting grapes? You did mention Finger Lakes, you know, down to the area. And I guess you'll just confirm, you know, the low intervention, you know, winemaking.
Yeah. So we're farming fully biodynamically. So only organic sprays. We're spraying, you know, the 500 horn manure prep in the spring. We spray 501 and 507, I think it is. So horsetail and the horn silica. So those are the drying sprays. Anytime we'll have a sulfur spray or one of the antifungals, we'll put one of those in the tank with it to try to get some drying effects out. And then the rest of the sprays go in the compost pile. And then we use that compost throughout the farm on the vineyard and in the vegetable beds and anything else that we're planting. And you know, we're not super, super strict with following the calendar. We're trying not to, basically for racking and things like that and bottling, we try to follow more what the, barometric pressure is doing rather than, you know, what the moons are
really
doing. There's not a lot of actual, scientific rigor, studies or proof that those moon cycles, even though they affect the tides, can really affect the pull on you know, the lees at the bottom of a barrel, for example, if you're racking. So I lean a little bit more towards the
pretty crazy.
The scientifically provable and repeatable side of the biodynamics,
right,
and less to the witchy side. But you know, it is something that you're out there, you're thinking about, it's meditative, you're stirring those preps for 30 minutes and just looking into the vortex, and you're thinking about what you're going out to do in the vines, and you're spending more time in the vines.
On the 10 acres you had mentioned last year, you got killed.
We did.
Was that the majority of what you had planted, or
that was we had planted a small planting of about 400 vines the first year by hand, and then we got 1,200 planted last year with the help of a machine planter, which was amazing. But now it's like 70% of those are gone. So we've got about 50% of our vines that we planted still intact, and that's only about an acre. That's it's pretty densely planted for an acre. We have a very small row and spacing set up, and then we have about half to three quarter of an acre of mixed fruit and nut trees that are the start of the permaculture orchard, which is right abuts the vineyard. We're 2 years behind, I said, so we're just going to be waiting for a while for that stuff. So
right.
we've got the vineyard, Brunswick Vineyard, up the road, which has Chardonnay, Cab Franc, and Traminet. They actually have zero fruit this year because they lost all of their canes and all their buds to the winter freeze. So we're buying some more Finger Lakes fruit this year. But we have a vineyard that we get a lot of hybrids from up in Valley Falls, which is like outside of Troy, New York, way up in the Capital Region.
Right.
And that's a grower who was 80% of the way towards being organic. He was just spraying a little bit of fungicide, but he had chickens for pest control and fertilizer. He had never used herbicides, and so we said, hey, I'll buy and ship you the spray, use this, not that. And last year he did that and went really well, so this year the whole vineyard is organic, and we're buying all the fruit from him this year, so about 8 tons of fruit. Unfortunately, he sold the vineyard, so now we're going to have to talk to the new owners and say, hey, let's please continue this relationship, keep the organic going, and we'll buy all your fruit and we'll pay you a premium.
So there's a pretty big pull, not distraction, of keeping up on all of that stuff? I mean, you're dealing with the climate, obviously, but you're dealing with, you know, people who are growing, trying to, you know, create relationships with those guys.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know,
juggling a lot of balls.
The old joke is that winemaking is 90% cleaning, and I would say, yeah, that's that's probably true, but also of that remaining 10%, most of that is logistics and management. And we're talking about, yeah, managing these relationships, managing your books, managing moving fruit around, getting your pickups in time, getting your bins where they need to be so they can get filled with fruit.
But who's doing that all? It's basically you and your wife?
Yeah.
A friend here and there or whatever during harvest? Yeah,
we have a lot of volunteers who come up and help with bottling and harvest, which is awesome. It's been a lifesaver because there's really not, there's like there is in California, we don't have an existing infrastructure of vineyard management.
Right.
Teams who have crews that will come in and pick for you. If we could pay someone to go and pick this 8 acres, I mean, I would pay it tomorrow, just please, or 8 tons rather, just get it in for me. And now instead I'm up there for, it's going to be the fifth day in a week doing a 15-hour day to try to get as much fruit in as we can.
Is that a business we should look into?
I thought about it. Yeah, yeah. I have.
Maybe.
I have, yeah.
All right. We'll talk about that later. Obviously, the environs of the Hudson Valley are unique, and I think certainly the grapes are. And in setting up, you know, what you do and you make, let's talk about the grapes, you know, in the Hudson Valley. A lot of varietals. People may have heard of once or never heard of. I need you to explain what a hybrid grape is, sort of where they came from. And let's talk specifically about, you know, kind of focusing on the grapes, you know, that you're working with.
Sure.
And you'd mentioned already more than a half a dozen.
Yeah, and there's actually a field blend that we're doing from that vineyard, Americi Vineyard, that's got over a dozen different hybrids, co-planted reds, whites, and pinks. And we just vinify them all together. But so
you sound like my friend Nate Reddy.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Something to aim for.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the, you know, Vitis vinifera are the grapes that most people know the names of.
The European
classic
variety,
grapes,
right.
Pinot Noir, Chardonnay. And those do not do super well in moisture, and they don't do super well in cool climates. There are some that do, so those are the ones that kind of made their way into New York State. Riesling in the Finger Lakes is a prime example. Dr. Constantine Frank did his job and showed us that that could be done. Cab Franc is taking off, Pinot Noir, and now there's some Gamay that's getting planted across New York, and I love that because Gamay on granite is just exactly what
works.
You want. White Cliff Vineyard has some Gamay planted up at their Olana Vineyard up near Hudson. I'm really trying to get my hands on some of that eventually, but I might have to plant my own. We'll see. But then what happened is these cool climate viticulturists started trying to figure out what they could do to breed those grapes with the native grapes that did survive well here. And so they took those Vitis vinifera grapes and they bred them with Vitis labrusca, Vitis riparia, all of the native and local grapes, and basically just over hundreds of years came up with all of these different versions of them that, you know, made it or didn't make it, made good wine or didn't make good wine, survived or didn't. And there's two basic sources for most of that plant material in the U.S., and that's the University of Minnesota and Cornell.
Right,
and
Cornell had a big hand in that because they were in the Finger Lakes.
Yeah, exactly. And so both of those sources have kind of gone up and down the East Coast and been planted everywhere. So we have, you know, we have La Crescent and Louis Swenson and Marquette and things, other things from University of Minnesota planted all over New York. And then we have the Geneva hybrids, Cayuga, and all the ones that are a little like Baco Noir, things that you might have seen in the tasting rooms of the Hudson Valley
right.
in the past. And so those are all planted up and down, but a lot of them had been kind of just blended into named wines instead of done varietally. A lot of, I think, the problems of the past vinifications have been trying to get them to fit into a box of maybe what their parentage was. You know, Marquette has a little bit of Pinot Noir in its parentage, and so saying, oh, this should be our Pinot, or this should be our Cab Sauv, or this should be whatever, I think forces you to try to make the wine into something that it doesn't necessarily
right,
want to
I
be.
Right, I think that's important.
And so that's the other good thing that the natural wine paradigm has brought to the table is the ability to say, let the grape do what it wants to do and then see what that is. And then so we've done a couple different vinifications with Marquette, for example, where let's see what it does when it's carbonic. Let's see what it does when it's whole cluster. Let's see what it does when it's pet nat. And, you know, we've had the best results are some
do
of the
you
ones we've had recently.
Single out a Marquette because it may have those Pinot characteristics?
No, no.
And those, you know, Gamay, Pinot, some of them are
no,
carbonic.
It's more of what wines have we tasted that we like from hybrid grapes. And that's been people who've come before me, like
right.
Deirdre Heekin at La Garagista has been doing it forever, and she's
up in
made
Vermont.
Amazing wines. And so, and then some of the guys like from Pinari Fee up in Quebec are making a lot of hybrid wines. And so you taste those wines made in the way that we like to make wines, and the ones that are good, you say, okay, that grape can do something
right.
magical.
I get it.
So that's where we
explain
start
something
looking.
To me when you talk about University of Minnesota and Cornell having a hand in this. Did they do the research, or do they provide the vine still?
They provided the original material, and then there are nurseries all over the country that have been propagating them. And some of them actually still have royalties on them that you have to pay back to the
right.
universities. And it'll when you go on the, you know, like AA Vineyards or whatever, one of the New York nurseries, it'll say this one has an extra 5 cents tacked on per vine. It goes back to University of Minnesota. But they had great breeding programs, and they had breeders in each place.
Right.
And like Elmer Swenson is like the famous one. That's where Louise Swenson comes from Minnesota. And yeah, they just kind of, if they are, you know, it's like an idea. If it does well, it starts to spread. People
yeah.
want to hear about it.
You're basically... I mean, it sounds like you're using a zillion different grapes, but if you had to narrow it down, I mean, you're working with 6, 8,
nine
grapes year in.
Riesling, Chardonnay, Cab Franc are the go-to vinifera that we're able
is
to work
with. Is the Cab Franc a rosé, or you make a Cab Franc?
We do
Franc?
Both. We
you do,
you
do a Cab Franc and a rosé.
We do a little rosé every year because we really like the way Cab Franc does a rosé.
Is the Riesling from Finger Lakes? Or
we have our 17 Riesling was from the Hudson River region, and the 18 we got some from the Finger Lakes. This year we're doing a little bit of both.
Can you differentiate?
Yeah, I mean, they're completely different.
They are completely.
Yeah, they're completely different. And
I mean, what if you drank both, what's the obvious difference?
Just from the two vinifications that we've done from those two
right.
vineyards.
Well, that's what you go by.
Yeah, the Hudson River region has a little bit... I mean, I hate, you know, nobody wants to use the word minerality, but it's got a little bit more of a non-fruit character, a little bit more, maybe because we do a little whole cluster, maybe the stems are imparting a little
anything
bit more.
Anything with
of
the
a,
granite on that or not?
It could be,
right.
But
not
you know,
necessarily.
You know, I like the new idea that the geology is really more differentiating the texture of the wine, not really showing up as a specific flavor. Brenna Quigley talks about that a lot.
Right. She's a rock star.
Yeah.
terrible. All right. So you said Riesling, you said Cab Franc, you said Chardonnay. Let's leave Piquette for last, which is not the grape, but what else?
And then on the other side, we've got Marquette, which is a red hybrid, which is a tincturier grape. So it's got red flesh too. So we did a Pet Nat Rosé out of that, but it was still dark red. And then Treminet, which is a hybrid of Gewürztraminer that grows right by us in the Brunswick Vineyard. It's got a ton of Gewürz character, so lychee, elderflower,
right.
white and yellow
all
flowers,
that sort of exotic.
And we do a whole cluster maceration with that. So give it 2 weeks of skin contact and it just blows it out. And you're walking a fine line between, you know, like going into Bed Bath & Beyond territory or
right.
Bath & Body Works, I guess.
Right.
But it's really, if you get the acidity right and you get the body right, it's a really nice, fun wine and different. And then, you know, Noiré and Cayuga, those are two New York classics. Noiré is just full of Rotundone.
N-O-I-R-E-T,
yep.
We spelled before.
Yep, N-O-I-R-E-T. And it's got Rotundone, which is that black pepper note that you find in cool climate Syrah. So last year we took some of that and co-fermented it with some Cayuga, which is a floral aromatic white, the same way they add a little Viognier to their
right.
Syrah and Northern Rhone.
The Northern Rhone.
So yeah, I was starting out in 16, I wasn't super excited to be working, as excited to be working with hybrids as I am now. I was like, yeah, we're going to make some hybrid wines. It'll be part of what we
Why?
Do. I'd only had a couple good ones from our friends, and I'd had so many bad ones.
Just from experience.
Yeah, so I was like, I want to make Cab Franc, I want to make Pinot, I want to make Chardonnay, I want to grow those things.
A little like a snob, but that's all right.
No, I got over it very quickly.
Yeah.
Well, so our first big vintage in 17, the Skin Contact Traminette that we made, was my favorite wine that we made that year. So we named it Luca after our daughter, who was born the same year. So that was my turning point. Then there I was all in on hybrids.
Are there or is there a grape that you haven't worked with yet that is in the region that you'd like to?
That's the Gamay. Play with. And Pinot,
the locally grown Gamay.
And Pinot is hard to come by up there, and that's why I planted some, because I want to work with Pinot.
So Gamay, you would just make a Hudson Valley Beaujolais?
That's the other thing that I don't like to try to do, is try to say, make this wine, but in this region. Like, our Cab Francs are Loire-like. They're lower alcohol, they're higher acid, there's a little dusty minerality, there's a little green, but I'm not trying to make a Chenon in the Hudson River region. I'm trying to make a Hudson River region Cab Franc. But yes, of course, I would love to make it.
I get it. And what about the Pinot? Just make a straight up Pinot?
I mean, I'd like to see what it would do. My friend Zach in the Niagara Escarpment on the other side of the state makes one of my favorite domestic Pinots.
It's delish.
Yeah, it's amazing. They're on limestone there on the escarpment, so that's a little different than what we would have down here. But
It'll all come. You'll see.
Hopefully.
All right, let's talk about something that you've been tagged with in a good way, which is Piquette.
Sure.
P-I-Q-U-E-T-T-E. Explain, Piquette is a thing. It's not a grape.
Yep.
Explain what Piquette is, and then weave me into what you're doing.
All right. So Piquette is a historical beverage. And, I mean, you can trace the roots of it all the way back to antiquity. The Greeks and the Romans were watering down their wine. There was the Laura of the Roman Empire that the soldiers would make when they were on tour. But really what we're focusing on is this 19th century European thing. And Piquette was a French name. The Italians had one called Acquarella, where they would call it Acquapazza, crazy water, which is my favorite name for it. But essentially what it was is the growers and the farmers and the field workers couldn't afford wine, and they couldn't drink water because it was full of bacteria and would kill them. And so they had to come up with something they could drink. And so they would take the pomace left over from winemaking and take it home, or sometimes if it was a big house grower, they would do it themselves.
The winery pretty much discarded a lot of it, just put it in buckets and left it to be.
And it was like, you know, it's like squeezing the last few drops of water out of a sponge. You would soak it with water and press it again and let
you would add water.
Right, exactly. So you add the water back.
Would you let it sit?
I have a dozen old recipes that we've been working on translating and looking through, and you know, it's basically
quick to letting it sit.
Yeah,
it varies.
Done 100 different ways. Okay. Adding other herbs and spices and other stuff to it. Everyone had their kind of way of making it palatable. I like to look at it in the same way that the poor and the butchers had to take the offcuts of meat and offal and turn them into something delicious, which, you know, in the last 15 years has come back in restaurants in a huge way. It's like, foie gras is here and oxtails and everything.
You know, nose to tail and everything in between. But you don't just take the pomace and add water.
So, yeah, we did a lot of different trials. And it was, you know, we had already done, so in the first year, we had done a second wash, which is adding water to our pomace, because we wanted to play with distillation and make some grappa. And then my friend Tristan, who works at Kingston Wine Company, showed me this passage in a book called The Red and the White, History of Wine in 18th Century Europe. And he's like, why don't you try this? And I'm like, okay, well, we're already doing that. Let's just not distill it. Let's just leave it in the barrels and see what happens. And then come spring, we basically did, you know, 2-3 dozen trials where we added a little bit of wine back to it or left it plain. So we did like plain 5%, 10%, 50% wine. And then we bottled it with 5, 10, 15 grams per liter of wildflower honey as tirage. That's what we use for our sparkling in the bottle. And we did that with all the
your
different...
Your honey or you...
No, we get it from an apiary 5 minutes region, from us. Yeah,
local.
Right in Pine Bush too, yeah. Yeah, we don't have hives yet. We built a chicken coop this year, but we still haven't gotten the chickens.
Does the honey stimulate fermentation?
So that's our like tirage in sparkling champagne production when they're adding the sugar for the secondary ferment in bottle. So we're not doing it Pat Nat style. We're doing it. It's not necessarily method traditionnel. It's more like col fondo because we don't disgorge it. So we put a little sugar in, put the cap on, and then it starts up again in the bottle. And it's just enough to give it three atmospheres, you know, like between beer and sparkling wine.
How long is it? What's the minimum for the process to run its course?
So we like to leave the piquette with a little bit of the wine added back to it to bulk age over the winter, because what happens is the pH jumps up a lot, and at that higher pH, you get a lot more lactic acid bacterial activity. So all the funky stuff that you try to keep out of a beer, unless you're making a sour beer, or you try to keep at bay in wine, we let it run wild. And that's what gives it the funk, the sourness, the interest, because otherwise it really tastes like watery wine. But when you start to get these secondary and tertiary compounds that it makes, it really gives it some interest. And so we let that bulk age, and then in the spring, usually we do the bottling with the honey, and then we leave it in the bottle for another month or two to carbonate and to settle out. We did it. We tried it. It turned out pretty well. We're like, oh, let's sell this cheap. We can get a little more money from our grapes.
Hit the ground hard, right?
Yeah, and keep our wines cheaper. For us, it's a philosophical monetary thing that we're doing. We're making something that's fun and glue, but it lets us keep our prices on our bottles at the 20 to 30 range instead of the 30 to 40 range.
That worked out well. We've been drinking it, and it's a delicious wine. It's a beautiful sort of pink grapefruity.
Yeah.
Very drinkable. We'll talk about it a little more during the wine sip. Before we get to our wine list, I just wanted to ask you a few things. I think I met you maybe 2 years ago at Raw Wine.
Yeah.
And then I bumped into you last year at Jenny and Francois, your distributor's portfolio tasting. One of the ways that you get people in the trade to taste your wine and get out there is at these fairs.
Sure, yeah.
And you've been to Raw Wine Fair, but you had a hand in creating...
Yeah, so we did this year a Catskill Wine Summit.
It just happened, right?
Yeah, we did it in August. We were selling wine to this restaurant at a resort up there, and they kind of asked us if we'd be interested in helping out put together a wine fair. And I said, yes, if we could do 100% New York wines. They were into it. And so, you know, I ended up asking about 25 or 30 wineries, and it just so happens that only my friends said yes. So it happened to be a pretty tight-knit, not all super natural-leaning, but just people doing really good terroir-focused, low-intervention-ish winemaking and growing good food.
I know you had, like, Bloomer Creek down from the Finger Lakes, and you had a bunch of the local guys.
Zach and Eric, our crew.
Is that something that'll happen again next year?
Yeah, it was awesome. It wasn't huge. You know, we sold 100 tickets, but it was a pretty good crowd for what it was. Yeah, and
That's a success.
The venue loved it. They want to do it again. I think all the vendors had a really good time. Everyone who attended had a good time. So we're going to try to make it a little bigger next year and just, you know, keep showcasing New York wine from across the region.
I think that'll happen. You know, Raw Wine's coming into New York. And what's crazy to me is, you know, Raw Wine is such a terrific venture. But now there's these off-wine fairs.
Yeah, there's a lot.
And you're involved in a few of them. I think there's the Peripheral.
Yep. They've been doing that for a couple of years, actually. We haven't been able to do it.
Yeah, I didn't imply that they were new, but yeah.
Right before Raw, so we could never do all of them. But yeah, Peripheral is the right before Raw.
Coming up
in Hudson, New York. Yeah.
Right.
And then, yeah, the Wild World Festival, which was, I guess, in Austin for the first time last year.
Byron Bates?
Yeah, is doing one in New York.
Right.
It's actually, I guess, on the Monday of Raw.
I think what I'll do is on our social, I'll post, you know, information if people want to know. But you'll be at Peripheral.
Yep, I'll be at Peripheral and I'll be at Wild World. And then, last year, just to tag on to that, the LA Times did a wine bowl in Los Angeles. That was really fun. And then our friends at Old Westminster Winery did the Burnt Hill Solstice Festival down in Maryland. And so they're popping up everywhere. There's all these really amazing wine festivals.
I'm very happy to see that. The culture expands. All right, Todd, we can't let you leave without doing our wine list. We ask all our guests 5 questions. Same 5 questions to everyone. Spontaneous. Don't dwell on them. guys like Kirk Sutherland or Raj Parr, you know, gave stellar answers, so you don't have to get
nervous. Pressure. No pressure.
All right. They're very base questions. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? Besides you, you know, I was yelling at you in the our green room. It's the wood room. I'm like, what are you doing here? You're in the middle of harvest. Why'd you say yes to the show and all of that? So you're in the thick of harvest and tasting wines. But separate of that, what are you drinking now? What are you tasting? What's in the fridge? What's interesting you?
Can I say cider and beer? Is that possible?
Yeah.
A lot of really good New York cider. We just did a cider tour with a bunch of the other New Yorkers with Glenwood Farm up in New York. But beer is the go-to for harvest season.
So two quick things. Give me one or two favorite ciders.
Sundstrom cider, Leif Sundstrom.
S-U-N-D-S-T-O-R-O-M,
yeah. Okay. And then Metal House Cider is doing some really awesome forage stuff up there. And then beer has just been, it's like, you know, it's the go-to cheap beer usually, but we like to do a little bit more than cheap beer. So like Hudson Valley Brewing has amazing stuff coming out. And then people have been bringing up stuff from the Referend in New Jersey, doing all sorts of crazy barrel-aged sour beers. Yeah. Yeah. I'm waiting for Jersey and Pennsylvania to start making some really good natural wine because it's coming. I guarantee you.
Yeah,
you're
right.
There's some vineyards there, and there's people that are on the fringes and on the edges.
It ain't happening in Jersey right now, but they just need one guy like you to, like, you know,
whoever wants to do it.
All right, next question, goofiest question on the list, but tell me your favorite wine and food pairing.
Oh, that's easy.
It is?
Yeah. Cab Franc and anything with fennel sausage. So sausage pizza and Cab Franc, anything like that. It's just
a grilled sausage with fennel
sausage
and a glass
peppers.
Of Cab Franc?
It's just like it's got, if you go.
Why does that work?
Because a little peppery, like green peppery note is like the classic pairing for that fennel sausage. So it's a really good.
That's a first on the Grape Nation, which I like. All right. Do your best to answer this without excluding anyone. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar. So you are a New Yorker,
right?
Upstate and downstate. Yep. You're in the Valley, which is a very hot area. We're sitting in Roberta's, you know, which could easily be one of the answers. But give me a couple of places where they do it well. You know, a place where they have a great variety, like a Roberta's, and a guy who knows what he's doing, like a Kirk, and, you know, reasonable prices and enthusiastic people, and great food to go with it.
Okay, so besides Roberta's, which is amazing, Brunette Wine Bar up in Kingston, New York is amazing. They've been doing awesome stuff up there for a long time. And then I guess just to keep it a little off the beaten path, well, I think the usual is now starting to get a lot of recognition.
Anthony. He's the cover boy.
Yeah. So
he'll be on the show in 3 weeks.
Yeah, I think Alice actually said that when she was on, so I guess I'm stealing her answer. But Pinch Chinese also has like such an amazing list and just really awesome food to go with it.
That's the Filipino mafia you just mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
Jonelle, Anthony, yeah. And who's the guy from Pinch?
Miguel,
right?
Leon, yeah.
What about, you didn't leave Brooklyn that long ago.
June Wine Bar.
June Wine Bar is a great natural wine bar.
I haven't been able to go to some of the new spots out there yet. But
all right. Good job on that. Do you have a favorite all-time wine?
Oh.
And in the old days, it used to be the rarest, most expensive.
Yeah, I think...
now it's experiential.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I love Burgundy, but I can't afford it. But the few opportunities I've had to drink really great Burgundy with some age on it, Crystal, my partner, bought like a 99 Grand Cru Maisie Chambertin for us for my birthday 1 year, and we had it at the Nomad with the roast chicken. It was amazing. Joseph Roti was a producer. But I think even maybe on top of that was I had a 92 Chambol Moussy Amarousse from, I think it was just Druhan, like one of the Irish producers. But I got it a long time ago and I'd forgotten about it, but we were planting the Pinot vines, the first Pinot vines in our property, and I drank it with Crystal and our friends and my brother, and it was just...
So Burgundy.
Perfect, yeah.
But good stories. All right, last question, and I think you could handle this. Tell me, recommend the best wine around $15-$20 retail. Give me a red, give me a white. You can go by category, like white Muscadet is always a good answer. But if you have something interesting.
Besides Piquet.
No, let's put the top of the list as Piquet and maybe one or two other wines.
All right, so White, I mean, I'm going to stick with New York, and I'm going to say New York Riesling. There's plenty of them absolutely under $20. Like, Ravines has a dry Riesling that I think is 15
great,
to 17.
Great answer.
And then Fjord from the Hudson River region. They have just their
FJORD?
Yeah, regular dry Riesling that's about $15 to $17. Great. I've seen it on glass lists for pretty cheap, so I know.
How it's about a red?
Affordable. Red is harder. I mean, it's hard to make cheap wine in the way that we like to make it. But I think...
It's not cheap. It's inexpensive.
Yeah, inexpensive. Sorry.
Right.
I think probably looking for things. I know red blend has become a bad word. A red blend has a certain connotation. I like red blends.
The prisoner.
But I think if you're going to a small producer like us that has something that they kind of put together with their offcuts to make a glass pour wine, like my friend Zach at Litton Bouffel has a parking lot that's a blend of his different Pinots that he's able to put together. I think it comes in under $20. On the shelf. Look for VDFs from France or like a red blend from a small producer that you like. They usually have a cheaper
good
one.
Stuff. And if I didn't mention, I will post Todd's answers on social, and we're going to segue into our weekly wine sip, where every week we taste a different wine on air. I asked Todd if he would bring in stuff and let him bring whatever he wanted in. We kicked it off with a Piquette. And now we're going to try a couple other things, and you're going to tell me what. I've brought my tasting crew in to help me taste, and that's Kirk Sutherland, who runs the wine program at Roberta, and Kat Johnson from Heritage Radio.
The so Reckon crew in here.
What are we tasting here?
So we're going to drink our
and new- I have four glasses. Kirk, that's yours.
Our new Marquette that's just coming out in this current release. Our mailing list release just went out. Sign up for the mailing list if you're not on there.
Now's a good time to segue, and I'll do it at the end of the show,
all
too.
Right,
so
sure,
the mailing
sure.
list is?
Just on our website, wilddarkfarm.com. You can sign up, and then we release our wines direct to consumer twice a year in the spring and in the fall, and that's the easiest and cheapest way to make sure you can get all of our wines before they go out to distribution. So this is coming out in the next, it's out now, and you get it shipped in the next
so
month.
This is the Marquette, so Marquette.
This is the third.
This is a hybrid?
It's a hybrid from the University of Minnesota. This is grown up at Americi Vineyard in Valley Falls, New York, fully organic.
Is Valley Falls the Hudson region?
It's actually outside the AVA, and he's the old grower.
Not that I care. But it's not Finger Lakes.
It's still in the area. It's Washington County, that's what it's called. And so this is a third different vinification that we did on this wine. This one is whole cluster, 50% whole cluster macerated for 2 weeks, and then pressed into a combination of one new chestnut barrel and glass demijohns. And we had a chestnut barrel that we had bought for cider, and we didn't get enough apples last year because it was a tough year for apple yields. So we're like, let's put some wine in.
This is your first chestnut barrel wine?
Yeah, it's our first chestnut barrel
wine. Here we go.
Where's the chestnut from?
It's a French tonnellery. I forget. It starts with a D.
So it's French.
French chestnut.
It's French chestnut. Okay. All right. So let's give this a sniff, and then we'll throw it over the tongue, and let's do a quick evaluation. So the color is a nice purple. You know, close to deep. You know, the edges. Goes to the edges. So beautiful color.
It's hard to get light color on Marquette. It's just
it is.
Inky black when you're pressing it.
So this is an inky black. It's a nice purple.
Yeah, it settles out pretty nicely.
Tell me what we get on the nose. Is there a classic Marquette nose?
I mean, I don't know. It's only my first vintage working
Kirk,
with it.
Kirk, what do you get on the nose?
I mean, I don't know if there's even a classic Marquette nose. You know, you definitely get that carbonic influence on it where it's very spicy and stemmy and fresh.
All good.
It smells very enticing. I mean, after I give it a sniff, my mouth is definitely watering.
All right, so then
mostly
let's...
Mostly red-fruited, I would
yeah,
say.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Let's go to mouthfeel. I mean, typically it's a medium wine. Not thin, not unctuous, right?
Yeah, no, it's... you could make it that way, I suppose, if you really push your sugar on it, but we harvest this at 20-ish, 21 bricks.
Nice little 11%. Acidity.
Yeah, high acid. This
nice.
This came in at like 308 last year, pH, so...
Does the palate match the nose? I mean, what are we getting on the palate?
Yeah, I think so. Spice. Mostly crunchy red fruit and a little spice. And it's like, it's my first time working with new chestnut, or I think even drinking something from new chestnut in the wine world. So I'm
Kirk,
trying to figure out what it is.
Do you pick any chestnut up?
I mean, it doesn't really present as a new wood-influenced wine whatsoever.
Right.
I would assume that, you know, chestnut, the grain on it is very, very tight. So if you're doing something that does have a carbonic sort of influence on it, you're going to retain all of that freshness on it. It doesn't really throw a lot of those sort of like vanilla intense right. flavors that
smoky oak vanilla would. Oaky.
Nope. Yeah,
it's more of like a generalized urban.
Very
yeah, it, there's it. It just doesn't feel like it was fermented in something super super porous or new whatsoever. Right. It feels more like, you know, tight grained, really bright, acid retaining red fruit to it.
And let the wine come through yeah. without the yeah. wood. All right. Both of you can answer this. What's a good food pairing for this kind of wine?
Maybe a pepperoni pizza.
Pepperoni yeah. pizza?
I mean, I'm going to pair pizza with everything.
You're in the right place for that.
I make a lot of pizza at home because I moved out of the city and I needed to learn. So that's, I guess, always at the top of my mind.
But it would go with meats and all of that. All right. So that is, what's the vintage year?
This is 18.
That's the 2018 Wild Arc Farm Marquette.
Marquette.
Do we have anything else to taste?
Sure, yeah.
Before we go off, my engineer Jeet's looking at me like I'm going to strangle you when you get out here. But I'm like, you're going to have to break the door down.
We're drinking here, Jeet.
All right. And then, just quickly, we didn't really talk about it, but we tasted the Piquette in the can, and the Piquette was made from what grape, Pommes?
This one was a blend. It's our first blended Piquette, so it was started off with a field blend of Noiré and Cayuga, and then there's a little bit of Chardonnay and Riesling and Cab Franc in there. We kind of just we're kind of working with mixing and matching until we hit a balance.
Came out
Yeah, we put it.
I mean, Kat, you had it; it was delicious.
I said I've been drinking it all summer.
Yep,
awesome.
All right, so what are we drinking now?
So we're gonna take you on a trip to lovely Long Island. So from the North Fork, from Southold, we've got Teraldigo from the old Southold Farm and Cellar Vineyard.
Take a second and spell for me: T O R
T E R. T-E-R.
That's how it was.
O-L-D-E-G-O. Teraldigo.
And that's on the island?
It is. There's a few plantings across the states. There's one up at Redtail Ridge in the Finger Lakes also, and then there's someone in California has a little bit.
Nobody vents it on the island, though.
I mean, Southold did. They had
maybe Channing, but I don't even.
I don't think he does. Yeah, he does. Oh, okay.
He may be the only other guy. Right?
So yeah. So, yeah, it's a northern Italian variety, Alpine, Alto Adige. Elisabetta Foradori is one of the most famous practitioners in the natural wine world. So some of this came available last year, and we said, yeah, let's try it out. And so it's much more expensive to buy fruit on Long Island than it is in the Finger Lakes or where we are. So this was very expensive for us. So we had to make the Piquette out of it, but we also then took the pomace post-Piquette and soaked cider on it and made our Sweetheart pink cider from last release. So we really
So quickly,
squeezed.
Sweetheart is the name of the
It was a cider, the name that we gave, cider, yeah, and of, it's a cider. Northern Spy Cider on Teraldigo grape skins. Yeah.
We had it in the Blanca pairing.
Very fancy. All right, so color, I mean, this may even be deeper than the Marquette.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, right? Definitely.
All right, so that's color. What are we getting on the nose? Interesting nose, beautiful. I'm terrible at descriptors.
Floral, herbal, and then a little bit of raspberry or black raspberry fruit, I think.
Is it weird if I say it's almost like a cedar closet thing going on?
No, and there's a little bit of pickle juice on the nose.
Oh, pickle juice, all right.
Yeah, there is, yeah.
Okay, in a good way. I'm not.
Little volatility, maybe.
No. All right, so that's the nose.
I mean, it's an Italian grape, so it's got to have a little VA.
Right.
If you're doing it justice.
The mouthfeel. Medium body.
A little more mouthfeel. Yeah, than the other
Absolutely.
One. Absolutely. So this was like 5 weeks on the skins and stems, 40% whole cluster, whereas the Marquette was only 2 weeks. So you definitely get a lot more structure there, a lot more plush roundness, too.
It's more mouth-filling. Palate descriptors. What's the fruit? A darker fruit?
You know, a lot of people describe the, you know, impetus of Teraldigo as looking at its parent grapes, which are Syrah and Pinot Noir. And this very much presents more to me as that, like, Syrah range of fruit. Where
a little
it's
more spice.
Like darker.
Darker.
Red, blue, berry, a little bit of olive.
I agree.
It's pretty savory.
Yeah, it does have it's very, very savory, savory. Herby character.
You know what? The nose to me now is more olive than pickle juice.
No, that's it was something briny. Mm-hmm. You couldn't land on it.
But only in a good way. I mean, I would shut up if I didn't like it or I was trying to be negative.
I mean, at the restaurant here, I always, whenever a guest says they like Syrah and they want to taste something out of their
right, you know, give me something interesting.
I would show them Giraldio.
I think that's a good call.
Especially from Elisabetta Foradori.
All right, so what do we pair with this, a wine like this?
More on the meaty side, maybe some roast pork. What goes together, like, you know, Northern Italian kind of heartier fare, meat and cheese.
Good call.
Dishes.
So that's a 2018?
That is an 18 too, yes.
18. Yeah. How do we pronounce it again?
Teraldigo. I think.
Whatever.
I have some Italian heritage, but, you know, I never learned how to speak the language, so.
All right, so, Todd, let's go over this again. If people want to get more information on Wild Arc Farms and the wines and what you're doing, they go to the website?
The website, wildarkfarm.com, or, I mean, we're very active on Instagram, at Wild Arc Farm.
Okay.
That's how we put out our calls for volunteers.
WILDARC, Arc Farm, FARM, yeah. Right. We end the show with that anyway, but that's really, yeah. I mean, it's morphed from Facebook and websites to stuff like Instagram and all of that. All right, we're going to wrap the show up. We ran a little late, but that's okay because anytime you're drinking wine and three or four different wines, you know, screw everyone. So, all right, if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation, on Instagram at SBenRuby, and the hashtag The Grape Nation on both of those, Heritage Radio. On Facebook, it's Heritage Radio Network. On Instagram, it's Heritage_Radio. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. As I said, we will post Todd's wine list, all his interesting picks, and I will give you the lineup of everything we drank today, starting from the Piquette to the Tora Bora, whatever. Tora the Doggle.
What was it?
Teraldigo. I'll list everything, the vintages and all that. I'll also list Todd's.
Terror.
All right, so Todd, once again, on social, the preference is Instagram at Wild Arc Farm.
I'm at T Cavallo if anyone wants
to. Right, I wanted to ask you that. If people want to see, you know, what you're doing,
I basically post back and forth between the two. It's all the same content, so.
Yeah, but I mean, sometimes you put something up that's a little more personal.
I'm sure you talked about 40 under 40, right?
He mentioned
it. I did mention that.
At the top.
Congratulations.
I did mention
that. Thank you.
Wow.
Just under the wire. I turned 40 in a couple months.
He didn't say it, but it was a joyful thing, but the most aggravating thing was he had to put a clean shirt on for the photo shoot, which bothered him. All right, I want to thank our guest, Todd Cavallo. Todd from Wild Arc Farm, doing a lot of great and interesting things. Very close to home. You know, we do the show from Roberta's restaurant, Pizza, in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Todd, you came down here earlier today. What was the drive?
Hour 40 and a half? Minutes,
Under 2 hours, so it's very cool what's going on.
I always say we wanted to be the Loire Valley is to Paris, just filling the restaurants and cafes.
You're on your way. Besides talking Kirk into drinking your wines, we get Pascaline in here, and, you know, you're good. All right, like I said, we'll post Todd's wine list and weekly wine sip stuff. Thanks again, Todd. Thank you to our engineer, Jeet, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.